Hello, welcome to our latest episode of the Brighter Thinking Pod from Cambridge University Press with me, your host, Cara Smalley, Commissioning Editor for Computing here at Cambridge. The Brighter Thinking Pod has been created to support teachers around the world. Each episode brings you helpful advice and interesting conversations from some of our brighter thinkers, authors, teachers, and academics, with a sprinkle of entertainment on the side as well. Today, we're going to be taking a closer look at teaching programming to primary and lower secondary learners, and we'll hear from two very special guests. For this episode, we're joined by Senior Lecturer in Computing Education at the University of Hertfordshire, Neil Rickus, and Teacher of Computing at Cromsall Lane Primary School, Director of BCS's Barefoot Programme and Computing PGCE Lead at the University of Manchester, Dr. John Chippendall, known as Chip. Neil and Chip are both authors on our upcoming primary and lower secondary computing series. As mentioned, we're going to be discussing ways you can approach teaching programming with your learners based on questions from global teachers just like you. Remember, all the links and information that we discuss are available in the show notes for your ease. And if you want to get your voice heard on the show, you can get in touch on Twitter using the hashtag BrighterPod or by email at educationmarketing@cambridge.org. So let's start by saying hi to our guests. Hi, Neil. Hi, Chip. Welcome. Great to have you here with us. How are you both?
Yeah, very good. Thank you. Thanks for having me onto the podcast.
Yep, and I'm also good. I'm really excited to be here today, so thanks for inviting me.
We're very, very thrilled to have you. We like to start each show with an icebreaker, and today we thought we'd start by discussing something quite fun. So, Neil, what was your favourite computer game as a child and why?
Well, for me, it's Super Mario World on the Super Nintendo. I think it's the perfect 2D platformer. You've got engaging graphics, really nice pixel art, great sound and music, and lots of challenges, some of them linked to problem solving, a bit like programming, perhaps. And I'm proud to say I've completed it with all 96 exits found, even the special levels, and still play it to this day. It's really nice on the Nintendo Switch Online platform as well.
I have to agree, but I'm only on 84 exits, so, you know, I've got a ways to go.
One day.
And Chip, what about you?
Am I allowed to have two?
I think we'll allow it this time.
just to, because one of them, I know, would you call it a game? So Microsoft Flight Simulator, I have played on that from when I was a very small boy and continue to this day, and I've kind of evolved with it. It's now on VR and it's very realistic and I love it. But then thinking back as well, I can remember Duck Hunt, which I think was Nintendo, and it was like the first game that I'd used that had the hardware of the gun that you could work, you know, and point and shoot at the ducks on screen. And what's the phrase about any sufficiently advanced technology? Arthur C. Clarke being like magic. I can remember thinking back then, you know, this feels like magic, the fact that I could just point this gun at the TV and shoot the ducks. And it kind of sparked my interest a little bit in how that technology worked. So, yeah, sorry, I had to go for two there.
Did you know that you can actually control the ducks with a Player 2 controller?
I did not know that. What, so you can try and fly away from the other person with the gun?
Yeah.
Well, there you go. I'll have to dig it out.
And there's, on another slightly geeky note, there's also an issue with playing it nowadays because LCD TVs can't handle old light gun technology. They used a trick with the old CRT, the cathode ray tube, to make it work. So you actually have to get a different bit of tech to make it function nowadays.
Every day is a school day. Thank you for sharing that, Neil. Wow. Yeah, I did. I've got to say though, I haven't had it out recently to play, so I wasn't aware of that it wouldn't work. But thanks for letting me know.
I think excellent choices on all fronts. I have to, you know, I feel like I have to answer as well. Mine was Dragon Quest III. I never played Dragon Quest I or Dragon Quest II. But I was obsessed with Dragon Quest III, and it kind of sparked this lifelong fascination with fantasy games and literature as well. So a lot of thanks to Dragon Quest III from me there. So thanks for sharing that. Always happy to talk about video games. So let's move on to the serious stuff, the questions. Our first question today is from Alison from our teacher community in West Asia. Alison asks for some advice on how to introduce learners to programming for the first time. Alison's looking specifically for some play-based activities that might be good for an early years or primary stage one classroom. Chip, do you have any advice for Alison here?
Yeah, so the first thing I wanted to talk about was just to pick up on Alison's question there and the use of play-based as a kind of approach to teaching, the pedagogy there. And I think that it's great to see that kind of acknowledgement of the real benefits and of letting pupils learn through a kind of exploratory play-based approach. We often call it tinkering in the world of kind of computing education. For me, the two of my kind of go-to tools for tinkering to learn how to program in that kind of age range are BeBots, you know, the hardware, the little BeBot robot, an app that I really like is Daisy the Dinosaur. So that's a kind of very, very basic introduction to block-based programming, so where you can make sort of sequence of commands and do a bit of repetition as well. But the other thing I'd probably also add is that, and I'm sure that, I think Neil might agree, is that actually before you jump to the devices, you can do a lot of stuff unplugged as well. So teaching without technology, developing those kind of initial skills of computational thinking, problem solving, logical reasoning, by doing things like sequencing activities of everyday tasks. And that's the kind of precursor then of moving on to using some of those skills, but with devices like the BeBot or apps like Dave the Dinosaur.
That's great. Thank you, Chip. Do you have anything to add, Neil?
Yeah, those unplugged activities are great, although we do need to ensure that if we do an activity such as pretending to be a robot, we then work with children to actually link it to something that they do at the machine so they relate one to the other. Otherwise, they might just remember a fun activity being robots. Chip mentioned about the apps that are out there. Daisy the Dinosaur, for example, is great. And these allow children to develop their understanding of programming concepts and computational thinking. And another great place to look is the Hour of Code. And they've got loads of applications that you can filter by age and the type of programming environment to help develop your skills in this area. Now, as great as these games are to use perhaps at the start or an end of a sequence of learning, there is an issue that all children progress in the same way, so it might limit their ability to be creative perhaps. So platforms like Scratch Junior, for example, are really useful as they can enable children to complete open-ended tasks that are of interest to themselves.
Yeah, I'd echo Neil's comments. That's a really good point, Neil. You know, with these kind of what I call challenge-based apps, can you complete this level? It can kind of build up this misconception that there's only one way to code a solution to things. And as Neil, you've just said, you know, actually, you know, coding, programming can be a real kind of creative pursuit. And there's often different ways with trade-offs. You know, this way might be better because it's less code and quicker, but it's not as easy to read and understand the code. So from a young age, if you can get pupils onto apps like Scratch Junior, then they have that more creative experience of programming.
And even when they're kind of starting out with kind of logical thinking, not necessarily at a device, kind of, for example, making a pizza is a kind of algorithm where you can have different, you know, branches. You could have mushrooms on it or just cheese, that kind of thing. Ensuring that they know that there are different solutions is really important, it sounds like.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, there's not always just one single right way to code things.
You can make that really exciting with kind of relatable examples like, you know, like pizza or a toy or something like that. So, yeah.
Yeah, what we also have as a benefit there is we don't need access to loads of kit too. if we only have a few computers that we can use, we can do all these activities with limited resources.
Yeah, in terms of the point there about as well, that, you know, there's different ways to do things. Maybe I wouldn't use this as an example for that age group, but slightly older pupils, I talk about the difference in my shopping technique to my wife's. And I'll be honest now, from the off, you know, I'm far less efficient because, you know, if you imagine you had a shopping robot and you were going to create a program for it, what's the most efficient way when you join your parents and you go around the supermarket? Do you order your list so all of the things that you want to get are kind of clustered together so that you're getting all the fruit and veg? Or do you just put the list at a random order and then you go to the first thing and then you go to the next thing? It's just a kind of example of a different algorithm for your approach to shopping can actually make things a lot less effective. So I'll be honest, I've been a bit deliberately ineffective, so now I don't have to do that job so much in our household.
That's a fantastic example. That's fantastic for sort of slightly older learners. Thanks for sharing that. In our new primary and lower secondary computing series, we include projects based around the PRIM approach to teaching programming, which stands for Predict, Run, Investigate, Modify, and Make. The question we'd like to put to both of you now is, what is PRIM and how can it be used effectively to teach computing? Neil, I'm going to come to you first on this one, please.
It sounds good. So it might be useful if I go through each stage first, just to explain what's involved, to help us understand it a bit better. So in the predict stage, we would view some code, some instructions, and discuss how it works. And it's important that pupils are given lots of opportunity to read code rather than just writing it. If we think about teaching children to read and write, for example, reading comes first before you start learning to spell and actually write words. In the run stage, the children run the program to see if they were correct. And the code here ideally should be provided so we don't have any errors when inputting code or dragging blocks of instructions together. In the investigate stage, we examine how the program works. There's a number of different approaches we can use here, such as answering questions about what the blocks do, or we might write comments against different sections of code, so using a comment block in Scratch, for example. And then we move on to the modify stage, where we can change different parts of the program, such as through customizing the text that's displayed, putting in different questions, different graphics, changing calculations, for example. And finally, when we get to the make stage, we can use the concepts examined in the program to make our own creation. And as we move from one stage to another, there's a shift from a program produced by someone else to a program that's actually produced by yourself, which gives us a sense of ownership.
Great. Thank you for that overview, Neil. Any more thoughts, Chip?
I'm a massive fan of PRIM. So we use PRIM throughout the writing that we've just been doing for the Cambridge Primary Computing Stage 1, 2 and 3. And because it's applicable whatever the age, I think that's the thing just to remind people here, you know, PRIM is not a age-specific pedagogy. You can be taking a PRIM approach using Scratch, introducing a new concept like repetition, or when you're working with BBots, you know, you could put, when you're working with BBots, going back to, you know, Alison's question before, you could have a series of command cards laid out and getting pupils to predict what they're going to do, then plug those commands in. So it's kind of, it's agnostic to the age range. I think that's worth remembering. I think also as well, just to say that you don't have to try and fit it all in one lesson. I think that it varies. And again, this can vary with age range. So you might kind of get through it all of those five stages in with younger pupils working with BBots in a lesson. Whereas with Scratch, I don't know what you think, Neil, but I would say with Scratch, with sort of higher older people's working on high level concepts, you might kind of do your predict and running and investigating in one session and building up that code comprehension, as Neil was talking about. And then what would you say, Neil, then move on to kind of doing the modify and the make in another session?
Yeah, it would depend how long you've got. And also, we might not always go through all five stages. It might be that we need to investigate a couple of concepts or a few new blocks before we can actually move on. So yeah, it might be spaced out over a period of a few lessons.
Yeah.
And that, absolutely, that is something that we see more with Python as we move through the stages, and we get to stages 7, 8, and 9, where we certainly split those concepts out, because there's no way it's feasible to do in a single lesson. So yeah, absolutely.
And I think it's the secondary setting, actually, that Prim was primarily developed in, and it's since then been sort of adopted by primary teachers. The only other thing I was going to say, actually, sorry, it just came to me, was that I found it's particularly effective, and you need to really pitch the predict part right, so that it surprises pupils. I mean, and this is kind of on the basis of, you know, general learning theory. We, you know, if pupils are flying through things too easily, you haven't pitched it high enough to challenge them and advance their learning. But that predict stage, you've got to really know your learners and provide them a bit of code where they probably understand 80% of it, but there's a few bits in there, those new concepts, which they don't quite know yet. And when you run it, they go, oh. And then that feeds into, well, let's work out, investigate what's actually gone on here. So it's, you know, as with all teaching, it's about knowing your learners and about knowing how to pitch it.
Brilliant. Our third question today is from Michael from our teacher community in South Africa, who asks, is programming for students who are good at maths? Now, not to preempt, but I actually find this quite a damaging misconception that tends to sort of limit the kind of students that feel they can take computing at a higher level. But I don't want to assume that that's what our experts are going to say. So let's start with Chip for this one.
Yeah, no, I agree. I think that too closely associating, you know, maths with programming and putting out that view too strongly can be off-putting, and then we lose a lot of people that actually could have done very well pursuing programming kind of further education level. I think things have changed here as well over time. Because what we're generally seeing in terms of the technology available in the actual industry for, you know, for the jobs of computer scientists, programmers, is a general move away from them being kind of super tech math heavy. So you've got these low code, no code platforms, and a colleague of mine was recently at Amazon and on education trip business, and whilst he was there, they were speaking to some of the in-house programmers who were working on various parts of the platform, and the majority of them were actually working in a low code environment. Two of them had retrained from being primary school teachers, which was interesting. So I think if you roll back a few years, I don't know exactly how many, but the link there, when we were working, when industry was using lower level languages which were much harder to read, the code reading part, and there was a lot stronger link, you'd be dealing with, you know, binary or approaching that level. I think the link was stronger with maths. I think that nowadays it is less so. It's obviously still there, but I think what's more important is just the kind of logical thinking element, which again has its kind of roots in maths, but it's not, you know, the real nitty gritty complex mathematics that it perhaps once was. But I don't know, Neil, what do you think?
Yeah, there's a real danger that we're giving the message that this is only for someone good at maths, or even perhaps only selecting students to study computing qualifications if they're good at maths as well, which I know happens in some institutions. And we're therefore limiting access to this subject that can be really creative, can be really engaging, and increasingly the research is showing that this is something for all people. So it's really important to get rid of these outdated views and to enable as wide range of people as possible to access it.
Absolutely, and it sort of does somewhat of a disservice to perhaps more creative students that prefer history and English and media studies to sort of not give them the level of computing knowledge that their STM counterparts might have, which might be detrimental coming into the workplace in the future as well. So it definitely feels like a dangerous assumption to make. And it's something I experienced actually at school. I was more of a humanities student and I really wanted to pursue computing, but I was told I could not because I was not the best math student, which I persevered with and insisted, and I'm very glad I did. So I suppose a follow-up question from me would be, if a student came to a teacher and said, I really want to do computing, but I don't feel like I'm very good at maths, what would you recommend the teacher say to the student?
So before I answer that one, can I just make a slight U-turn on my, that's a bit of an oxymoron, slight U-turn, isn't it? Because it's not a full U-turn though. But however, I just did think, you know, if you've got students listening who love maths and but would like to do computing and maybe thinking actually, oh, I didn't think it would allow me to, you know, to exploit my skills in both as much as possible, I would say that there are still opportunities in the programming tech field to get really into the high level maths, but it's more nowadays in the data science, data engineering, machine learning, actually developing very sophisticated algorithms that are able to learn for themselves and feedback on themselves, and it's all that kind of statistics and data-y stuff, which I know exists. I don't understand it enough even to know what I don't know in it, but I think those opportunities are still there. So I was just going to add that point. I think that, my mind's jumping around a little bit now, but the other thing I was going to add as well is I think there's a real challenge here between the mismatch of the educational experience of what computer science and programming is and the curriculum with actually what's required in industry. So, you know, even in the, you know, in England, in the computing GCSE, they're learning about things like binary and stuff. Whereas, you know, they're never, if they're going to work for Amazon in a low code, no code environment, they'll never need any of that. So there's a part of the discussion there as well around, you know, we're not, are we giving a, accurate picture to both students and to teachers, because the chances are if you've got a student asking this kind of question to a teacher, they're more likely to look at the curriculum and at the specifications and examples rather than really know what the end result in industry is like. I mean, Neil, you work more in the secondary space than I do. Is that a fair comment or...?
Yes, I was going to add that for some of our students, the ability to actually use applications effectively and understand how this machine works and be educated around that is often of real benefit and is going to prepare them really well for the world of work too. So I think we need a computing curriculum they have access to that includes a broad range of things in it, and that we're, that's not just focusing on a very small part of it.
So I think the takeaway message is essentially that computing is for every kind of student. You have your hard math students that really want to engage with that side of things, potentially students that aren't as interested in maths, there's plenty there to engage with as well. So I think it's important that we kind of allow all kinds of students to explore computing in whatever way that they are interested in. Thank you for that. Michael also sent another question through, which I think others might also find useful. He asks, what are some computing concepts we need to teach? We thought it would be good if we approached this through the lens of 21st century skills and the fact that technology is constantly changing and evolving, and requisite for the workplace. We're going to come to you first, Neil. So what computing concepts do you think are important for learners to know in a constantly changing technological landscape?
Yeah, it's really nice to hear you talking about concepts, as we often hear in the computing classroom that we're doing Scratch or we're looking at PowerPoint today. So there's a focus on the applications rather than the underlying concepts, which means that children have difficulty applying their knowledge and understanding to different situations. So something we want children to develop are their computational thinking skills. Now, computers can't think. They only do exactly what we tell them. They're pretty stupid. It's one or zero, on or off. Although this is perhaps becoming a little bit more interesting with the advent of artificial intelligence and machine learning, going back to John's point earlier about what's happening at Amazon, for example. But computational thinking involves using a computer to solve a problem, and lots of those thinking skills are very similar to the 21st century skills that you mentioned a minute ago. So we can think of this as a number of concepts and approaches, perhaps. For example, it might involve pupils using decomposition to break down a problem into different parts, which then makes it easier to solve, or collaborating with other people as part of the problem-solving process. And then children can use these thinking skills in a range of different scenarios when they're tackling a problem to solve.
Great, thank you, Neil. And you, Chip?
Yeah, so just picking up on what Neil said there, and echoing what he said, nice to be talking about concepts. I think for me it boils down to basically three. If we're talking about programming on that side of things, because I think also actually it'd be worth in a second touching on the kind of world of digital literacy here as well. But with programming and computer science side of things, pretty much all programs can be boiled down to sequence, selection, and repetition. They're like the three building blocks of pretty much all programs. So a lot of, you know, the work that I do, the writing that I've done, whether for Cambridge or other resources, you know, those are the core blocks that you're looking at, and you're building a progression up in those. And in with that, you need an understanding of data structures, because programs need to work on data. And, you know, if you've got understanding of those core, what we call constructs, actually, the sequence, selection, and repetition, and data structures, you can pretty much move between Python or Scratch or a low-code, no-code environment, and you just know that you're looking for, right, how do I make a conditional? How do I hold a bit of information in a variable? So I would say that those are the kind of traditional, if we're talking about hard coding, traditional programming, those are the kind of core constructs. But as Neil touched upon, things change a little bit in the world when you introduce AI and machine learning. It's a different kettle of fish, really. There you kind of need more of an understanding of data. And particularly some of the, I think what's really important for us to teach going forward is some of the limitations of technology such as AI and machine learning, and the potential for bias in that. You know, I would never get on an aeroplane that's controlled by machine learning, because you've only ever got a certain confidence level in that technology working. It's not exact, you know. It might have worked 100 times before, and on 101 you want it to turn left and it turns right because it's just misinterpreted where it is slightly. You never actually know it's going to do the right thing. So we're kind of going into the world of, you know, sort of social understanding now, which is important that we develop in pupils for concepts that we teach. So the other one I would add to that is mis and disinformation, and an understanding of how technology is being used in kind of information wars. So I kind of drifted off a little bit from programming and tech, but these are all, I think, really important concepts that we need to be teaching pupils going forward.
It's lovely to hear you touch on those social things. We're veering into sort of my territory a little bit more here, which is great. So just thinking of the primary classroom, particularly, you know, the very early stages, 1, 2, and 3, how might we sort of start to introduce these ideas that early, do you think?
Well, it's a bit like you know, prim in the sense that actually, so if we're going back to these core kind of constructs of traditional programming, you can teach those with a age appropriate app or piece of hardware. So I wouldn't be using Python to introduce sequence in year two. I'd be using Scratch Junior. Scratch Junior also allows you to do a bit of repetition. Then Neil, would you say then coming into kind of key stage two onwards, you start to look at selection?
Yeah, typically, and we would give children lots of scenarios to examine that and also look at how that might then link in with some of these other concepts as well. So giving them lots of opportunities to see how it can be used in different situations.
Yeah, it's nice to use kind of different programming languages, I find, as well. Not too many, but just enough so that pupils start to spot the pattern that, you know, okay, if they go into Scratch or they go into, say they're using Spheros, which is a kind of a robot, then they'll find the same kind of constructs there. So they start to recognise that these are kind of fundamental constructs in all languages.
Thanks very much to Neil Rickus and Dr. John Chippendall. Thank you also to anyone who sent in any questions. We'd love to hear from you, so please do keep them coming. Neil, where can people find out more about you?
The best place is probably on Twitter. I'm at Computing Champs.
Fantastic, thank you. And Chip?
And I'm also on Twitter as at Dr. Chips _. And just to say, you do need the underscore because at Dr. Chips is an aspiring American teenage rapper, and that is not me.
Fantastic. I think I'll need to follow both of those accounts.
And it's not Mr. Chips off Catchphrase.
It's not, no, Dr. Neil, I worked hard for that.
And that's all for our Approaches to Teaching programming episode. Don't forget to tell your friends about us and rate our show on whatever platform you're listening on. Our show notes have lots of useful links that we've discussed throughout this episode, so be sure to take a look at them. You can also follow us on Twitter at CUPEducation or use the hashtag BrighterThinking to get in touch. That's it for today. Thanks again to Neil and Chip, and we'll see you, our lovely listeners, very soon.